Highly processed flours and grains, such as today's white rice, did not exist because the technology was not available to accomplish such complete refining and fiber removal. According to the U.S. Department of Agriculture statistics, American food manufacturers are using an average of over 154 pounds of added refined sugar per person per year. That is over one-third of a pound, or 53 teaspoons per day. Add to that the consumption of large amounts of high glycemic index carbohydrates that we eat, and we have individuals with glucose overdose for their under-designed digestive systems. Does consumption of refined sugar and highly refined carbohydrates cause or aggravate diabetes? It certainly does aggravate diabetes, and studies of large populations over many years strongly suggest that excess refined sugar and refined carbohydrate consumption is either directly or indirectly causing diabetes, or at least speeding its onset by causing so many people to become obese and or insulin resistant. Examination of data from the Harvard Nurses' Health Study by Dr. Jorge Salmerion et al. Sounded a loud wake-up call about the risks associated with developing type 2 diabetes. That study of 65,173 previously healthy women, ages 40 to 65, found that the women who ate a high glycemic and low fiber diet had a 250% greater chance of developing diabetes than those who ate a low glycemic, high fiber diet. The study also recommended that diets should include minimally refined grains, as Sugar Busters recommends. This type of diet is obviously a great way to help prevent diabetes. The conclusions from this world-renowned study have broken the backs of the critics who have said there was no value in using the glycemic index or glycemic load in helping to guide one's diet. Let us examine other statistics. The rate of diabetes in the United States has more than tripled since 1958, which correlates closely with increased sugar consumption. What else are we consuming in amounts so different from what our recent forebears ate? Certainly not fat. The percentage of calories from fat in our diets has actually decreased since the late 1970s, from 40% to 34%. More important, the actual consumption per person per day is down from 85 grams to 73 grams, a 16% drop. Yet the incidence of obesity has doubled since the late 1970s, and on average, people weigh 11 to 12 pounds more than when they were consuming larger quantities of fat. What products other than sugar are we consuming at such an increasing rate? Sodas? Coffee? Well, sodas usually contain huge quantities of sugar, so when you drink soda, you're just adding sugar to your diet. Does coffee cause diabetes or obesity? We don't think so. Coffee is not a problem unless you add large amounts of sugar or drink excessive amounts and get too much caffeine, which may cause other problems. Because the rate of obesity in the United States for both children and adults has more than doubled since the 1960s, with most of the increase since 1980, and because sugar consumption has gone up another 20% just since 1980, what better correlation does anyone want between consumption of nutritionless refined sugar and what is causing us to get fat? Is not the answer to this dramatic increase in the rates of obesity and diabetes so blatantly obvious that it defies logic for everyone not to see it? How much more obvious can the connection between refined sugar consumption and obesity and diabetes get? Add to this the fact that the correlation also makes physiological sense. Most people with diabetes were fat before they became diabetic. Guyton and Hall's Textbook of Medical Physiology, 2000, The doctor's Bible on physiology indicates that most sugars or carbohydrates are converted to fat when consumed. Some of the glucose is converted to glycogen to be used for future energy needs. The body's ability to store or hold glycogen is limited to only a few hundred grams. The glucose that is not readily used or converted to glycogen is converted to fat, which is easily stored. The body can store many grams of fat. There are 2.2 pounds in each kilogram. This is not nutritional theory, but physiological fact. It is very easy to see the converted sugar as fat on us or on our friends. Couple guidance facts on physiology with the additional facts from Wilson and Foster's textbook on endocrinology, 1992. Figure 1 of this book on your PDF companion makes the answers very apparent. They are simple, straightforward, and best yet, logical. The answers make good common sense, unlike the claims of most of today's diets. If we would not eat so much refined sugar and high glycemic carbohydrates, the major portion of our population would not have these problems. Unfortunately, American medical schools do not include much nutrition and dietetics in the curriculum. Please urge your doctor to read this book, critique it, check its conclusions with factual data in medical textbooks, and see if he or she does not arrive at a similar conclusion as that found in Sugar Busters. Because high mean levels of insulin promote or accelerate obesity, hypertension, and heart disease, ask your doctor why so many nutritionists and even the American Diabetes Association still are recommending a carbohydrate-rich diet that causes our bodies to need more insulin. The success stories have been exhilarating. There is significant help available for both the borderline and full-fledged diabetic. We emphatically predict that as more research is conducted, the general way of eating presented in this book, which is closer to the way our distant ancestors ate, will ultimately replace the current faddish diets. Chapter 14. Hypoglycemia. Hypoglycemia is a very common problem in our population. The term hypoglycemia is used to indicate a low blood sugar level, usually below 50 milligrams per deciliter in adults. A blood sugar level below 40 milligrams per deciliter often requires medical attention. A person does not have to be a diabetic to have symptoms of hypoglycemia. Hypoglycemia frequently is the cause of the midday doldrums that many of us have experienced an hour or so after lunch. In the majority of instances, we have had a sugar-rich or high-glycemic, carbohydrate-rich meal that initially causes our blood sugar to rise with an associated significant insulin spike. See Figure 1 on your PDF companion. But when the insulin does its work and the blood sugar begins to fall, it often drops to below normal. How far it falls below normal varies from individual to individual. If you experience some of the symptoms discussed in this chapter, you may be prone to hypoglycemia, or you may just be unable to eat meals that are too full of high glycemic index foods. Research does point out that the more rapidly the blood sugar spikes and subsequently falls, the farther it will fall below normal. See Figure 7 on your PDF companion. There are three categories of hypoglycemia. 1. Reactive hypoglycemia, which we have just discussed and which is by far the most common form. 2. Spontaneous, such as conditions caused by tumors of the pancreas. And 3. Those that are induced by surgery, involving the gastrointestinal tract. The symptoms of hypoglycemia vary from lethargy to anxiety. For a small percentage of people, they even include depression. Mild to moderate symptoms include shakiness or trembling, pale skin, sweating, rapid pulse, hunger, irritability, poor coordination, dizziness, fatigue, sleepiness, headache, slurred speech, or daydreaming and lack of concentration. Our first response often is to want to eat something, usually another high-glycemic carbohydrate that elevates our blood sugar, making us feel temporarily better. However, the consumption of any significant amount of a high-glycemic food will cause the spike-crash phenomenon to repeat itself, which will cause the urge for still more food. As a result, our blood sugar and insulin levels will fluctuate in a definitely unhealthy fashion that could have been avoided by eating properly in the first place. Just eat a piece of fruit or drink a little juice to give yourself a mild blood sugar rise so you will not experience the roller coaster effect of high, then low blood sugar that caused your hypoglycemia initially. Diabetics, whether type 1 or type 2, often have bouts with hypoglycemia because insulin or oral diabetes medications, if not precisely balanced with proper amounts and timing of food consumption, can cause blood sugar to drop too low, hypoglycemia, as well as rise and remain too high, hyperglycemia. Persons with significant symptoms of hypoglycemia should certainly consult their physician for competent professional advice. However, in the majority of cases, mild hypoglycemia is purely a result of eating a meal rich in high glycemic carbohydrates. You frequently can avoid the symptoms associated with a low blood sugar level by following the Sugar Buster's lifestyle. And just think how much better your performance will be at work, at play, and even while driving after a low rather than high glycemic meal. Chapter 15. Sugar Busters for the Healthy Heart. Most of us follow a specific diet for one or two reasons, often to enhance our appearance or improve our cardiovascular health. Being slender seems to be considered more attractive by both men and women in America today. Most of us have tried to shed a few extra pounds before vacation or some important event. More recently, dieting to improve our health has been gaining greater importance. The cardiovascular system often is the target of these efforts. Therefore, we would like to elaborate a little about the cardiovascular system and the influence of diet. Diseases of the cardiovascular system, primarily heart attack, hypertension, and stroke, are public enemy number one, accounting for 12 million deaths annually in the United States. Coronary heart disease is the leading cause of death in industrialized countries, and in the next 10 years, coronary artery disease and stroke will become the leading cause of death in most developing countries. Heart disease, stroke, and frequently hypertension are due to the deterioration of arteries through a process called atherosclerosis, arteriosclerosis, or just plain hardening of the arteries. This process is a natural phenomenon of aging. As we get older, so do our arteries. The smooth inner lining, called the intima, begins to crack when the elastic, muscular middle layer can no longer fully recoil after a pulse wave has expanded the vessel. In these cracks, platelets, fibrin, calcium, cholesterol, and fat accumulate, creating an atheroma, or plaque. With continued stress on the arterial wall and further intimal, the innermost coat, disruption associated with blood flow turbulence, more material is deposited until the artery is narrowed significantly, producing reduced blood flow to the corresponding area of the body. We now refer to the process as a disease. Its presence has caused a problem. A frequent question asked of physicians is, how do I avoid getting arteriosclerosis? The answer is easy. Don't live long enough. Most patients do not like this alternative. However, some factors predispose us to premature or early arteriosclerosis and subsequently to cardiovascular disease. It is important to be aware of the risk factors and plan for them accordingly. Some we can alter, others we cannot. But the knowledge gleaned from being aware of them usually is very helpful in assisting us to enhance cardiovascular fitness or health. Initially, there were thought to be three major factors influencing early or premature development of arteriosclerosis. 1. Elevated cholesterol. 2. Elevated blood pressure. And 3. Smoking. However, we now know that many other factors significantly influence the process as well. These include the following: heredity, diabetes, elevated triglycerides, obesity, stress, sugar, and sedentary lifestyle. See Figure 12 on your PDF companion. Heredity, of all these factors, is the most important. Genetic factors contribute to an individual's susceptibility or resistance to cardiovascular disease. In addition, a part of the susceptibility and response to dietary factors is genetic in origin. Absolute control of the hereditary factor would involve picking our own parents, but for most of us this is not an option. Those individuals with a strong family history of arteriosclerotic cardiovascular disease should be especially aware of the other risk factors so that they can alter their lifestyles to minimize the negative influence on their systems. Smoking is a factor we all have the ability to control. The use of tobacco in all forms promotes the development of arteriosclerosis through a variety of mechanisms. The nicotine in tobacco is a powerful constrictor of blood vessels, causing reduced blood flow and a greater workload on the heart. Smokers have lower blood plasma levels of antioxidants, and we believe this makes them more susceptible to early plaque formation in arterial walls. The beneficial effects of many otherwise successful operations for complications of arteriosclerosis, such as coronary artery bypass, are more than cut in half by patients continuing to smoke. Diabetes mellitus has long been associated with early, diffuse, and often prematurely fatal arteriosclerosis. However, the diabetics most severely affected are the 85% or so who are insulin resistant. These individuals require increasingly higher plasma insulin levels to achieve the same result in regulating blood glucose. Elevated plasma insulin appears to promote fat deposits and smooth muscle growth in arterial walls. Both of these processes are involved in plaque formation. In addition, high levels of insulin probably make it easier for the blood to coagulate, which obviously leads to easier clot formation and arterial blockage. High blood pressure, or hypertension, is classified as essential in over 90% of instances. This means that we really do not know its cause, but we do know that it produces extra stress on both the heart and the arterial system. The diastolic, or bottom pressure in the blood pressure reading, is the force or resistance the heart and blood vessels are subjected to during the relaxation phase of the cardiac cycle, or heartbeat. The greater the stress during this phase, the more accelerated the aging, or deterioration, of the arterial walls. This leads to loss of elastic tissue, cracking, and, as seen, plaque formation. Certainly, controlling blood pressure reduces stress on the cardiovascular system and promotes better long-term wear. Hyperlipidemia, increased fat in the blood, especially hypercholesterolemia, elevated cholesterol, is associated with early onset of arteriosclerosis. Cholesterol is an important component in the formation of plaque. Cholesterol also is vital to the proper function of many bodily processes, such as steroid formation and the synthesis of lipoproteins, fat and protein combinations present in the blood, both of which are necessary for vital metabolic activities. Researchers also believe there is a link between cholesterol and insulin, as insulin-resistant diabetics, those with high plasma levels of insulin, have abnormally elevated cholesterol levels. The predominant cholesterol component in these individuals is the low-density lipoprotein, LDL, fraction, which frequently is referred to as bad cholesterol. Remember, for LDL, L means lethal. Some components of cholesterol, such as the high-density lipoprotein, HDL, fraction, especially HDL2 and HDL3, exert a protective effect on the cardiovascular system. Remember, for HDL, H means healthy. Gender is a factor in the development of arteriosclerosis, and in this instance, women have an advantage, at least until menopause. As discussed in the next chapter, estrogen in premenopausal women decreases blood plasma insulin levels. This imparts a significant protective influence on the cardiovascular system against the development of arteriosclerosis. After menopause, the incidence of arteriosclerosis in women begins to approach that seen in men. Even in the absence of all risk factors, arteriosclerosis will occur. It is the natural aging process of our arteries. The theoretical maximum life expectancy of the cardiovascular system is approximately 120 years. There is a fine line between arteriosclerosis as an aging process and as a disease. In the elderly, its presence often is termed normal aging, only to be reclassified as a disease when problems related to it arise. Rest assured, if we live long enough, we will develop arteriosclerosis. But consider the alternative. Obesity has long been associated with early cardiovascular system problems. In age-adjusted populations where obesity is low, life expectancy is greater. Just compare France and the United States. Between the ages of 16 and 50, the French have 50% less obesity and 20% less cardiovascular and cholesterol problems than their U.S. counterparts. Excess body fat is deposited throughout all body tissues, and the cardiovascular system is no exception. The additional weight imposed by the extra pounds also creates an extra workload for the cardiovascular system. Exercise, although not mandatory for many people in achieving weight loss or stabilization, is a definite plus in terms of both cardiovascular benefits and overall health. A more complete discussion on this important component for an optimum lifestyle occurs in Chapter 17. We are what we eat is an old adage familiar to almost everyone. But today this is becoming even more important as we better understand the full spectrum of nutrition and its effect on our various organ systems, especially the cardiovascular system. Although fats and meats, especially red meats, have fallen into disfavor and carbohydrates have been definitely in, few people stopped to think about what happens to the excess sugar that is the end product of carbohydrate metabolism. Some sugar is used in our blood to maintain an adequate circulating blood glucose level, and some will replenish glycogen stores in the liver and muscles. But what happens to the rest? It is converted to fat. Yes, most of our body fat comes from ingested sugar, not ingested fat. This conversion is facilitated by the hormone insulin. In addition, insulin tends to block lipolysis, the conversion of fat back to glucose. So individuals with elevated insulin levels have a more difficult time burning fat for energy. Simply stated, they have a hard time losing weight. Dietary sugar is now recognized as an independent risk factor for cardiovascular disease. This is caused by sugar's effect on insulin secretion. insulin is now recognized as being atherogenic. That is, it causes the development of arteriosclerotic plaques in or on the walls of blood vessels. In addition, insulin is now known to cause cardiac enlargement, more specifically, left ventricular hypertrophy. The left ventricle is the main pumping chamber of the heart and the chamber involved in 99% of heart attacks. Insulin plays a very important role by influencing many of the other factors we have been discussing. An increased insulin level also promotes fat deposition and growth of smooth muscle cells in the arteries, both necessary to plaque formation, and thus increases the tendency for clot formation. Two factors already discussed, estrogen and exercise, both decrease insulin resistance and are known to have a beneficial effect on the cardiovascular system in retarding the process of arteriosclerosis. However, one group of individuals, regardless of how well they positively influence most of the significant risk factors, appear to develop an early, diffuse type of arteriosclerotic cardiovascular disease that often leads to premature heart attacks, stroke, and complications of hypertension. This group is comprised of insulin-resistant diabetics in whom the only primary measurable abnormality is elevated insulin levels. It has become readily apparent to us, as well as others, that insulin has many influences on the recognized processes responsible for the development of cardiovascular disease through arteriosclerosis. Therefore, the key to improving performance and health through nutrition involves insulin. Modulating insulin secretion through diet may just be the most important variable influencing the development of cardiovascular disease. Chapter 8 discusses how this modulation is accomplished, as well as how it affects weight gain or loss. The Sugar Busters lifestyle, by positively influencing 8 of the 10 major cardiovascular risk factors, helps you keep and maintain a healthy heart. The Sugar Busters way of eating will improve weight and insulin levels. This will promote better blood pressure and blood chemistry, cholesterol, and triglycerides. Type 2 diabetes will either be entirely prevented or at least better controlled. Many have noticed fewer mood swings and have had a reduction of stress. All of those factors will benefit cardiovascular health. Combat the number one cause of premature death by following Sugar Busters and greatly improve your risk profile for a healthy heart. Chapter 16, Women and Weight Loss. Yes, women have more problems losing weight than men. However, some of the greatest Sugar Busters successes have been among women. One lady we know was able to lose 79 pounds over 5 months on the Sugar Busters lifestyle. Maggie Drezens-Moiti is a 51-year-old from New Orleans who has had a weight problem all of her life until she started the Sugar Busters lifestyle in 1997. When she graduated from high school, she weighed 120 pounds. But shortly after marriage and having children, her weight increased to 190 pounds. Following the sudden death of her husband, she began to eat excessively, finally reaching 319 pounds. Realizing something must be done, she reduced her food consumption and eliminated as much fat as she could from her diet. Over 18 months, she reduced her weight back to 190 pounds, where she again plateaued. Maggie was introduced to the Sugar Busters lifestyle, and over the next 5 months she was able to lose 79 pounds, dropping to her current weight of 111 pounds. She says that Sugar Busters is the most fantastic diet ever. She has always been a sweets freak, yet this way of eating has taken away her craving for sweets. Her energy, performance, and sense of well-being are all better. To help keep herself on track, Maggie makes a point of reviewing Sugar Busters every month and even refers to the book as my Bible. Following the Sugar Busters lifestyle has created a new figure and a new life for Maggie, who has married again. Maggie says, I think Sugar Busters is great. We have just recontacted Maggie, who has now been on the Sugar Busters lifestyle for 5 years. Maggie is still 200 pounds down in her weight and says she is full of energy and feels great. Yet all the prominent expert critics continue to say that diets that contain more than the historically recommended amount of protein, around 15% of the diet, only cause a temporary loss of water and weight. Please explain how Ms. Moiti could have been carrying 200 pounds of water rather than fat on her body? And do they consider 5 years a temporary weight loss? This is not a testimonial from a Joe or Sally or Jim or Jane. Maggie, as with all our testimonials, is a real person. Maggie also commented on the total volume of food she has been consuming. She says she is continuing to eat larger volumes of food, albeit different, lower glycemic food, than she was eating when she weighed 319 pounds, or when she had plateaued at her pre-Sugar Busters weight of 190 pounds. We salute you, Maggie Moiti, for helping to enlighten all the outdated experts who cannot seem to understand some very straightforward physiological processes regarding nutrition and metabolism. Another lady, Lala Ball Cooper from Memphis, Tennessee, wrote the following about her experience with Sugar Busters. My Sugar Busters journey began 18 months ago. How I found the motivation even to begin the trip is still a conundrum. I had, after all, long before that particular spring, completely abandoned any hope of unloading any portion of my substantial cushion of padding that surrounded what really was, in fact, a medium frame. A literal lifetime of weight battling stretched behind me as far as my memory could track, to early elementary school at least. Forever in search of a solution, and perennially unsuccessful in finding one, I had tried every year's dieting fad, one right after the other, until I had finally arrived at the point where the news of a possible new solution, even one accompanied by the glitziest media promo, could no longer pique my interest. I can't, then, explain how I found the motivation even to investigate the Sugar Busters book. I am still amazed that I bought a copy, and even more amazed that I read it and tried it in the first place. So high was the level of skepticism at the time, and so low the level of hope that any plan would ever succeed for me. Sugar Busters began to work immediately. Pounds started to fall away swiftly, but I was so heavy when I began that no one noticed at the high school where I teach, even after 2 months. I told no one that I was dieting. We perpetually fat folks finally learned not to advertise after so many failures. With my secret still intact, I spent the summer continuing to lose steadily. After I returned to teaching in the fall with a noticeably smaller body, my secret was out. I am now 124 pounds lighter than when I began. Although I lost the bulk of my weight during the first 8 months, I still continue to lose, although much more slowly now. The best part of all is that I haven't gained any weight back. To accomplish this, I've approached my new success with a new attitude. I know that Sugar Busters, for me, is not something that I will have the luxury of discarding after I reach my desirable weight. It is going to have to remain a habit of life if I intend to keep my weight off. Because it is based on valid nutritional principles and has eliminated the big enemy of dieters, deprivation, continuing this plan is something that I feel that I can reasonably expect to do over the long haul. I am healthier than I have ever been, as attested to by the blood chemistry reports I get from my doctor when I go for annual checkups. For the first time ever, I really believe that I am going to be able to put a heavyweight history behind me. Congratulations, Lala Ball Cooper. However, some women on Sugar Busters have become frustrated because of experiencing slower results in weight loss than their male counterparts. Michael Montagnac's most recent book, La Méthode Montagnac Spéciale Femme, addresses this problem. Montagnac identifies 4 points that he feels make it more difficult for women to lose weight. These are 1. Women are more sedentary than men. 2. Women snack more than men. 3. Women diet more than men, so their bodies are more resistant to diets. And 4. Women frequently are on hormone supplementation, which makes it more difficult to lose weight and actually may cause them to gain weight. Although the authors of Sugar Busters are not in total agreement with Montagnac, we do feel there is merit to some of his points. In general, women may exercise less vigorously and have less muscle mass to burn energy sources than their male counterparts do. More men jog or use highly resistant exercise machines, while women tend to participate more in aerobic exercise programs. However, you must remember that thousands of people are losing weight by closely following the Sugar Busters way of eating, even in the absence of exercise. Women who do not work outside the home tend to snack more than either working women or their male counterparts. This is only natural because someone frequently in and out of the kitchen has more opportunity to eat than someone who is away from home most of the day. Women taking certain hormone supplements, such as birth control pills, can have significant problems losing weight, especially if progesterone is involved. Progesterone increases appetite and definitely promotes fat storage. Many gynecologists use progesterone as an appetite stimulant in patients recovering from surgery or other procedures where improved nutrition and weight gain are desirable. If a woman is on hormonal supplementation of any kind, she should not discontinue it on her own, but should seek medical consultation. Many menopausal and postmenopausal women have been placed on hormone therapy combining estrogen and progesterone, which has made it more difficult for these women to lose weight. Based on a study of 16,000 women without heart disease, the government has recently circulated warnings that this combination has been proven to increase the relative risk of a woman developing heart disease by 29%, strokes by 41%, invasive breast cancer by 26%, blood clots in the veins by 107%, and blood clots in the lungs by 113%. While the discontinuation of this therapy may be bad news for women with hot flashes and other symptoms, it will be good news for those women who have been having trouble losing weight. Estrogen alone, however, may be beneficial to women trying to lose weight because it increases insulin sensitivity. Estrogen, therefore, acts similarly to exercise as an adjunct to the Sugar Busters lifestyle. All these things assist in lowering insulin levels. Moreover, women, on the average, are genetically more efficient at fat storage than men. This difference begins at birth and continues throughout life. Because women must support both themselves and the developing fetus during pregnancy, and both themselves and the nursing infant during lactation, their systems are more efficient at storing reserves that are available to support them during these times. The problem many women have in losing weight is real, and they need to review carefully all of the previous points in trying to achieve the best results from the Sugar Busters lifestyle. Obviously, some factors, such as hormones, are a stronger influence than others. However, for many women, it is important not to dismiss any of the points. For them, strict attention to detail will ultimately yield the satisfactory results that we are continuing to see in most women on the Sugar Busters lifestyle. According to Dr. Christian Northrup in The Wisdom of Menopause, about 25% of women have thyroid problems by the time they reach perimenopause. Since low thyroid function can cause your metabolic rate to drop, you should have your thyroid checked if you are adhering to the Sugar Busters lifestyle but are not seeing results. Another significant benefit of following the Sugar Busters lifestyle was pointed out by Dr. Benny R. Nobles of New Orleans. It was recently found that a common cause of fertility problems in female patients, specifically polycystic ovarian syndrome, was related to increased insulin resistance, which is common in obese women. Those patients, in an attempt to keep their blood sugar normal, would produce an abnormal amount of insulin to keep from becoming diabetic. After being treated with glucophage, a drug that is known to lower insulin requirements, many women began ovulating and became pregnant. It has now been found that many of the same benefits can be achieved by having the women follow a low glycemic diet accompanied by exercise. The Sugar Busters lifestyle, which lowers average blood insulin levels, has been effective in helping some of these women lower their previously elevated insulin levels and has helped some of them become pregnant. We thank Dr. Nobles for relating this additional benefit of the Sugar Busters lifestyle. Interestingly, many women on Sugar Busters who have also been on hormones have commented that, in spite of achieving only minimal success in losing weight, their dress size has decreased significantly, indicating that a redistribution of weight is occurring. This has led to a greater sense of well-being and improved self-image. Being lean and fit is a fantastic feeling. Do not deny yourself this attainable pleasure. Chapter 17. Exercise. Just over 100 years ago, exercise was difficult to avoid. There were no automobiles, airplanes, subways, or electrical appliances, all of which have now taken movement out of our daily lives. Today, our world encourages us to be lazy and expend few calories. Our heart rate, muscle tone, and insulin sensitivity deteriorate, and our fat storage and disease rates go up. A sedentary lifestyle definitely does not have a positive influence on the cardiovascular system or allow us to achieve optimum health. Inactivity may not be significantly harmful, but reasonable exercise is beneficial. Exercise decreases blood pressure, decreases serum lipoproteins, especially the bad cholesterol components, decreases obesity, decreases insulin resistance by increasing insulin sensitivity, decreases basal insulin levels, reduces the tendency for blood clot formation, and stimulates the breakdown of clots that have already been produced. However, the most common problem with exercise programs is that most people's intentions exceed their actual performance. At the other extreme, some people spend so much time and effort on high-impact exercises, like running marathons, that many end up with spinal or other joint problems. The maximum cardiovascular benefit can be achieved by exercising on a regular basis, 4 times a week, so that you elevate your resting heart rate to a prescribed level for a period of 20 consecutive minutes. To determine your ideal heart rate during exercise, you should subtract your age from 220 and multiply this number by 0.70, or 70%. This is the heart rate you should sustain for 20 minutes during an exercise program 4 times a week. If you choose to exercise more frequently and or for longer periods of time, that is your prerogative. But from a cardiovascular standpoint, exercising to elevate your heart rate to the prescribed level 4 times a week achieves the maximum benefit from exercise. A word of caution. If you are over 50 years of age, have cardiac risk factors, or are not accustomed to exercising, consult your physician before beginning your exercise program. Exercise is a tremendous adjunct to the Sugar Busters lifestyle. Both help us lower our mean insulin levels, and that is the goal we are all trying to achieve for healthier and longer lives. Exercise positively influences many of the risk factors governing our overall fitness, as well as the fitness of our cardiovascular systems. While this chapter is quite short, it is intended to give you a simple formula that will allow you to derive significant benefit from whatever form of exercise you choose. There must be thousands of machines on which you can exercise, plus millions of miles of trails, roads, and sidewalks on which to jog or walk. Just get your heart rate up to the prescribed number. Hold it there for at least 20 minutes. Do it several days a week, and you will have done what it takes to reap many of the benefits of an exercise program. Exercise alone will not always cause weight loss or even weight stabilization. This is true even for some people who exercise very strenuously. Often, a proper diet must accompany the program. Consider the letter we received from Ann Morley of Houston, Texas, that addresses exactly this point. I wanted to let you know how wonderfully successful I have been with your Sugar Busters program. I have taught aerobics for 18 years, and my body had gotten used to the workout. I am about to turn 40, and my metabolism went from the efficiency of a Porsche to that of a VW bug. Your program was the only thing that has worked for me. I have lost over 20 pounds and feel great. I have a ton of energy. I currently teach power cycling and Taibo classes 15 hours per week. The other wonderful side benefit from your Sugar Busters lifestyle is that my children are much less hyper in the evenings. I can see a huge difference in my preteen daughter and also some of her friends. We are all trying to steer ourselves from becoming victims of technological obesity. Too much TV, too much time on the computer. Many of my aerobic students have incorporated your program in their lives and are thoroughly enjoying it. I am a firm believer in Sugar Busters and am trying to spread the word. Thank you, Anne, for providing the proof that exercise alone does not always accomplish weight control or weight loss. Regular exercise usually increases bone density. If your doctor has informed you that you exhibit any of the signs of having osteoporosis, or if you are in a high-risk group, such as postmenopausal women with small bones, you would be wise to add some weight-bearing exercise to help keep your bones strong. These resistance-type exercises should be done at least twice a week and for 20 to 30 minutes per session. Since exercise increases insulin sensitivity, it is also very important in the treatment of, as well as in helping prevent, the development of diabetes. If the previous reasons are not enough to get you moving several times a week, consider the following. Stanford University and Veterans Affairs Healthcare Systems researchers studied more than 6,000 middle-aged men for 13 years and found that the men who had the best exercise capacity clearly outlived those with a lower exercise capacity. Those with the lowest exercise capacity had more than 4 times the risk of premature death than those with the highest capacity. Exercise capacity turned out to be a better predictor of death than even heart disease, diabetes, high blood pressure, or smoking. Get moving. Chapter 18. Superfoods. All of the foods described in this section are included in the very extensive list of acceptable foods for the Sugar Buster's lifestyle. We feel, however, that those discussed here do have special merit for anyone who is on any kind of balanced diet. These foods are loaded with vitamins, minerals, and in most cases, fiber, so they pack an impressive nutritional punch as well as delivering strong preventive medicine. With only one exception, some of the beans, our distant ancestors ate these foods raw. We still eat many of them raw, and there are healthy people around the world that do eat all but the beans raw. Fortunately, with proper preparation and cooking, most foods can retain their super nutritive punch and be delicious as well. To assist you in consuming these foods in the most enjoyable manner, we have included some very basic recipes when appropriate at the end of this chapter. The foods are not listed in any particular order because we strongly urge you to partake of all these foods, which can help ensure consumption of the vitamins, minerals, and fiber you require for optimum health. You also have the opportunity to enjoy eating these foods instead of going to the trouble and expense of taking many of the supplements that are so aggressively marketed to you today. Regulation on the claims made by many pill and potion pushers are very weak on non-prescription products, and some products have even been recalled after the products have been determined to be toxic to humans after prolonged use. Feeding your body with these superfoods presents your digestive system with the opportunity to extract the benefits your body requires in exactly the manner for which your digestive system was designed by Mother Nature. As mentioned in Chapter 5, researchers continue to isolate important new substances in the three food groups, and many of these important substances can't be found in any of today's pills or potions. Consider, too, that the various nutrients in wholesome, fresh foods may work together in ways that we don't yet fully understand, and that it's impossible to duplicate these complex combinations in a pill. Please notice something else about these superfoods. All but the seafood, olive oil, lean meats, and portions of the milk are carbohydrates, and thus are converted into glucose, sugar, in our bodies to produce the energy we require. All but sweet potatoes are low glycemic carbs, and sweet potatoes are only in the moderate range. Well, so much for Sugar Busters being a low-carbohydrate diet. We have always said Sugar Busters is simply about eating the right low-glycemic, high-fiber carbohydrates. Another good thing to remember each day is that to eat right, eat something bright. Red, orange, yellow, or dark green fruits and vegetables generally have more vitamins, minerals, and other nutrients than the less colorful foods. If you do not like the taste of some of these foods, find a way to disguise them. Your poor ancestors, who probably ate every edible thing they could get their hands on, did not have the arsenal of seasonings and spices you have at your fingertips. They had no A1 sauce, refined sugar, garlic, or salt. As you eat your next meal, think about your ancestors, tip your hat to them, and enjoy the pleasures of modern eating, except for those high glycemic carbs. 1. Greens. Kale, collards, and spinach. The creator of Popeye must have peeked at the nutrition table when he chose spinach as the food that made Popeye so strong. He even chose olive oil, also on our list, as Popeye's companion. We should all thank him for recommending such a nutritious food in a way that stimulated its consumption by many of us who otherwise would not have eaten spinach. Popeye was very fortunate, however, that Bluto, who got fat eating his hamburgers on white bread, did not dine on kale and collards, because their nutritive value can even exceed that of spinach in some categories. That said, whether you choose Popeye's spinach or the greens of King Kale or the Collard Queen, you have chosen a superfood. These greens, and others to a lesser degree, contain vitamin A, carotenoids, and vitamin C, all powerful antioxidants. They also contain a lot of calcium and fiber. All are extremely